Well, big thanks to Darren and the team for driving us through the afternoon. It's Thursday the 11th of June. I'm Marie Crowe and you're listening to Game On. Coming up between now and the new music show at 7pm, we're talking golf with Greg Allen and Doug Ferguson at the US Open. Keith Tracy is in studio to talk soccer. Plus, we'll be talking all things Gaelic games with Damien Lawler, Nadine Doherty and Aoife Murray. If you want to get in touch, you can text 51552, WhatsApp us on 087 187 9200 or you can find us on X at Game On. 2FM. This is 2FM's Game On. Welcome along. I am delighted to say that Keith Tracy is with me in studio this evening. We'll be talking all things football. I'm not sure if that's a really good thing after watching Ireland and Luxembourg last night, but Keith, here we are. That's where they are.
Yeah, this is going to be a little bit of an unloading session for me, I think. look, I didn't have huge expectations coming into the two friendly games. And at the start of the week, I thought that two friendlies, you can't put too much weight behind it. But to be honest with you, I didn't have an awful lot of confidence going in. And I'm probably right at that level before we start the World Cup qualifiers in September, to be honest.
But Keith, is it not difficult for players at the end of a season to try and get up for a friendly? It was pedestrian, I think, last night. It's probably a good way to put it. And I know the players had said afterwards that they were mentally tired because of the long season.
Yeah, look, I understand that, but they're playing Luxembourg. This wasn't a decent European team. And when we're looking and thinking, look, my mind goes again. I don't want to put too much weight into these two friendlies, but the World Cup qualifiers, we're going to be playing Armenia. It's a necessity we get 6 points off of Armenia. We've got to be hungry at home, and our first two games in September are hungry at home, Armenia away. Look, against the two games, the opposition is going to rise really, really steeply in September. We've become that little bit harder to beat, which I like. I still think we make some crazy decisions at time. I mean, the start of the second half in the first game against Senegal, we kicked off, we got the ball to Nathan Collins and he fired a hip height at O'Shea. And straight away, 10 seconds into the second half, we're under the cushion. You're thinking, what are you doing? Just don't do those silly things. We scored a goal against Senegal from a corner kick. We put it into the box, gets headed out to the edge of the box, gets held back in, and we scored a goal. The next time we get a corner, we play short. You're thinking, lads, you just need to be more sensible. And again, against Luxembourg, the manager said, you know, Tony O'Donoghue, you asked him last night, did we drop off the levels because we're tired, or did we drop off the levels because it's Luxembourg? And the manager said probably a bit of both. Mm-hmm. We're not good enough to pick and choose when we want to play. We have to have a blueprint. I remember saying this, I think 18 months, maybe 2 years ago, we played France at home under Stephen Kenny and we ran around like our lives depended on it. We got beaten the game 1-0 in the end, but I said that's the blueprint moving forward for us. And all of a sudden, we haven't been beaten in four games. We beat Bulgaria twice, a poor Bulgarian team, and the team thinks, well, do you know what, Jason, and I'll go and get it off the centre-halves, I'll go and do this. And this hasn't worked for years. Don't start leading into it thinking we're brilliant footballers again. We're not. We've become harder to beat, become a little bit more pragmatic. We still struggle to keep goals out of the back of the net. We haven't kept an awful lot of clean sheets. We struggle to score goals and we don't have a midfield that can keep the ball. So it still isn't looking very good for us, although I take the point, we're getting harder to beat, which is a plus.
And you'd have to think, Keith, that given the level that they were at last night, that they can move through the gears a little bit. Like, there is room there for improvement.
There is room for improvement. And again, look, is anybody more convinced after these two friendlies that we might get out of the World Cup qualifying group? If anything, I've probably gone a little bit backwards in it. To be honest, I think we won't get anything off of Portugal over the two legs. To beat Armenia, to get the 6 points would be brilliant. I'm not so sure about going to Yerevan and being able to do that. We've struggled over there in the past. And then we're thinking, can we be hungry in Dublin and not get beaten away from home? It's going to be a big, big struggle for us, Marie. And nothing I've seen over the course of the two friendlies, people say the Senegal draw is a good draw. That was a Senegal D team. You know, they left
not even B.
They left an awful lot of players on the bench. And be honest, they turned over England last night and you can see they had one eye on the England game. They looked at us and thought, we don't need to go all in on that. We should be able to deal with the Irish. They didn't show us much respect with the team they put out. And he still managed to get a draw here. So, look, the Aviva's becoming harder place for teams to go. We're becoming harder to beat. But all in all, Marie, I think we're still a million miles away from qualifying.
Are you judging that, or making that assessment about the qualifiers coming down the track on those two friendlies, or what Hal Grimson has done as a whole?
Well, Halgrimson has done as a whole. Oh, I think it's 10 games now Hamer's been in charge for. I think he's kept one clean sheet, scored maybe 8 goals, conceded in around 15. So again, you know, in the midfield, it's a huge, huge problem. So often we nick the ball really high and Jason Knight will drop the shoulder and think, now we need to kill a pass, and he comes back out so often. And it's not just Knight. When Cullen comes in, he does it a lot. And I look at that team, and the one thing that gives me a little bit of hope for September is I hope Chidozie Ogbeni, he comes back fired and fit. I know he's missed an awful lot of season. We need Schmoddix as well. People are saying to me, McAteer looks a great player. Finnezaz, when he comes back, Finnezaz has become a better player all of a sudden since he hasn't played for Ireland. He's become better and better, but I still think the squad we have, we need to keep it really, really simple. The Parrott and Ferguson relationship doesn't seem to be happening just yet. And
what's going on there, do you think?
Well, I think you have a player who's played an awful lot of football and is in the groove, and you've got a player who hasn't played an awful lot of football and is second guessing everything he's doing. Obviously Evan is the one who's second guessing what he's doing, hasn't played an awful lot, and he must be as low as a snake's belly when he gets that phone call from Graham Potter to take him out and get him on loan to West Ham. He must be thinking, brilliant. Mikel Antonio was in a very unfortunate car accident and breaks his leg, so you're thinking, clear room for Evan to play games. Fulkrug was never going to play at West Ham, but Evan just didn't seem to be able to force his way in. They were playing Jared Bowen through the middle, so he must have been as low as a snake's belly. Then he comes into the Irish team, it's a little bit disjointed. But look, who is our number one striker? We all say, well, it's going to be Evan for the next 10 years, but in the here and now, I think it deserves to be Troy Parrott. And again, I'm not too sure if Hamer is 100% sure of his best 11 just yet.
Is it fair to say that between now and when those qualifiers get underway in September, that the likelihood is Evan won't have played a lot of football?
Possibly. He might get a loan move in the time. I know Joe Pedro was possibly going to leave Brighton, but there's so many players within the Brighton team that you would imagine Evan is going to struggle to be the one to get the big bulk of minutes. But look, if a decent loan move comes in, even if it's on the continent somewhere, he should be looking at the likes of a Troy Parrott and thinks, look, if I can get out of the spotlight and still do me football, score a couple of goals, get the love, get that hunger back. And confidence players, wingers, strikers are always confidence players, and you can see at the minute Evan is just second guessing things. So I hope we're not in the same boat, but I think Hamer has come out and said you need to be playing regular football to get into this Irish team, and sometimes that can be a stick to be used to beat you with. But Evans is somebody that I would be willing to make allowances for because he is so talented, but we need match sharpness.
Yeah, I think everybody just wanted him over these last couple of games to come out and play. And he did well, I thought, in the Senegal game. But just to come out, maybe score a few goals, something that would just show that spark is there, just needs to be reignited again. Jonjo Patrick-Finn, he seemed to have something about him anyway, a little bit more technical, I think, maybe than people are expecting as well. But positive.
Yeah, positive.
I'm very cautious now here with you, Keith, because I'm not sure, did you see too many positives?
No, well, I didn't see an awful lot of positives, but Jonjo Patrick-Finn coming on is obviously a positive. New faces in and around the building. And look, is he somebody that you're looking at for September to come in and start and everything's going to change within the Irish team? Probably not, but he's a nice addition, as is Casey McAteer, a nice addition. I don't see them coming in and setting the world on fire on us and, you know, everything's going to be all right moving forward. But we're starting to add little bits of competition all over the place, which is what you need in a dressing room to thrive. I still think we miss leaders when Seamus is not around. I really do think we miss him. And the fact that we're looking around when we've got Nathan Collins and a whole host of Premier League centre-half, Premier League defenders, but we struggle for leaders in the defensively, in midfield. We look like a quiet team. And this is the sort of things I say to Pat's under-17s. Lads, if you communicate, the game becomes an awful lot easier for everybody. Check your left shoulder, drop off. We seem to be, well, this is my job and I'll do it, and whatever happens outside of my sphere, it is what it is. And it can never be that. You've got to do your job and your mate's job, and, you know, a team ethic, really. And look, we've become harder to beat, Marie. I think that's all I've seen over the two friendlies. But, yeah, confidence is still at an all-time low with me.
Okay, so harder to beat. There's a bit more depth there. Good night for Max O'Leary. Good to see him getting his cap. Been very patient.
Yeah, it's brilliant. What was it, six years since he first came in and he's got his cap. It's brilliant. I mean, I ended up with six Irish caps myself, and I went to probably every trip for about 3 years. I turned up and you don't get the cap. And it's so strange because I got my first cap against Argentina in the opening of the Aviva. The first time I was ever called up to the senior team, I ended up getting onto the pitch and playing, and I thought, geez, this international stuff is easy. I've cracked it. And I didn't play again for weeks and months, and I kept coming, kept turning up, but just couldn't get onto the pitch. And it can become very, very frustrating. And you have to think, no fan or no Irish man or woman wants to hear this, but when you get called up for an international in June, you always think in your head, I could be on a beach here if I really wanted to be. And fair play to Max, he turns up every time, and he, brilliant to see him get a cap.
Killian Phillips is another one. He's actually going to be on Game On tomorrow night as well. We're excited. But again, getting his opportunity. Good to see him, Kilbarrick lad, and a really good story as well. Will we see more of him, do you think?
I'm not too sure. I think you're right, Marie. Coming all the way up from Kilbarrick, it's great. It's Roy the Rover stuff. It's brilliant to see him get in an Ireland
cap. And
he's
definitely somebody who's not going. I could be on a beach here now. He's thrilled with his Irish caps.
That's exactly what you want. You want people chomping at the bit. Don't care if it's June. Don't care if it's in season, off season. Just want to play for Ireland. And Killian, you can see when he speaks. I was reading a piece and I'm saying he doesn't want to be a one cap wonder. That he has ambitions to keep playing for Ireland. Absolutely brilliant. That's what we want. And when you've got those lads in the dressing room and you've got those lads turning up the training, you've got to match their standards. So that will help everybody. It will help drive the standards around. But again, you look at September, you think, is Killian Phillips the one that's going to get on the half turn and make things happen? Probably not, but a good addition. And yeah, great to see him get a cap.
So as bad as we think things are after last night, I'm not sure that we can even come close to how Thomas Tuchel is feeling today, getting booed and losing to Senegal. And honeymoon period is well and truly over for him.
Yeah, I was listening to to his interview after and saying, look, we don't go to the World Cup next week. We have a year to prepare. And I get that some of the choices he made in the first game were very, very strange. He's got some of the best right backs in the world that can play in an England jersey. Yeah, he decides to throw Curtis Jones at right back. Some of the decisions, the way they've gone about it. And you look at the England team and some of them seem to already be on the beach in terms of their mentality. Mm-hmm. Senegal are a very, very good team, but on paper, you would imagine the English would have too much. And when a German man is in charge of an English team, you'd think the knives are going to come out pretty, pretty quickly. So the fact that he's already lost a game and there's some rumblings aren't good, but he's coming out and saying, I'm tempted to sign another deal to beyond the World Cup. So I don't think Thomas Tuchel will be feeling the pressure whatsoever.
I did enjoy reading the article on the BBC website. How worried should England fans be after defeat by Senegal? So it is getting quite hysterical very quickly.
Yeah, look, would you be that bothered if you're an England fan? Nobody wants to see their team losing friendlies, but like I say, Senegal are a really, really good team when they're at full strength, not when they play their D team in the Aviva, but very, very good team. So I think it's probably a little bit of an overreaction. Every time England lose a game, there's a little bit of reaction, but as I say, Senegal are a decent team. A lot of those England players are on the bench, on the beach already. They've had long, hard seasons, and a couple of players that are in the squad in terms of the Saudi Arabian based players, you're thinking, I'm not sure why they're there, you know. We're not sure of the validity or the standard within the Saudi Arabian League. So I'm not too sure. I think it'll be a lot different in September when the competitive games come, or the more competitive games.
Yeah, I'm actually looking forward to it. Even I know the friendlies weren't, they didn't set the world alight, the Irish friendlies. But still, I think there are some positives. And who knows, Hal Grimson seems confident. So it would be great to actually get to a World Cup. Keith, are you laughing at me?
Yeah, well, Hamer does seem confident. So he's doing a lot of good things in the media. He's saying, we're going to be there. We're planning on being there. I love all that sort of stuff.
I'm buying what he's selling at the moment, okay?
I'm trying to. I really am trying to. But my eyes won't lie to me. What I'm seeing, I'm thinking, it's a long way away us qualifying for a tournament.
Okay, well, look, let's move to the women's team because we have options now. It could be the women who are heading to a major tournament before the men do. I take either now at this stage. But first up, though, are the USA friendlies that Carla Ward's team are going to be playing later on this month. So Carla Ward has named a 23-player squad. Katie McCabe isn't there. We knew that she wasn't. She needed a bit of a break. She's had a really long season and that Champions League medal win. But just in terms of minutes and load and all the rest, she deserves a little bit of a break, I think. She named 23 players. Ellen Malloy is recalled. Hayley Nolan, Izzy Atkinson are also in as well. But she's named quite a strong team as well. And look, maybe that's something when we look at the men's qualifiers or the men's friendlies. Like, that momentum is important, Keith, isn't it? That you have that momentum when you're going into games and you have big, like they have their playoff game against Belgium coming up in October. But when you have something on the horizon to bring strong teams and get wins and build something.
Yeah, and I think that's the women are obviously an awful lot stronger than the men are these days. And you think the women, when you get a friendly, they can experiment with new players because they have that luxury because they're doing really well at the minute. When you look at the men are as low as a snake's belly, struggling to get wins and draws together. And you know, we're talking about Killian Phillips, O'Leary coming in, they're great and all, but like I say, you want that momentum, you want that familiarity when you go out onto the pitch. You know, well, I played with this fella before, I know what I'm doing. There's a fine line between appeasing people, giving them a pat on the back and keeping that momentum moving forward. Again, there's not an awful lot of friendlies in modern day football, so I understand why Hamer made an awful lot of choices, but I think if in an ideal world, Carlo Ward is the right way to go. You keep a tight bunch, keep the same players or the basis of the same players, and you move forward from there.
Yeah, it's a glamorous one as well, the USA, like, so there'll be a lot of eyeballs on it, and I'm sure everybody wants to play in it as well. Like, when you're given the opportunity to go to the US and play against one of the best teams in the world, everyone will be jumping up and down for it. Keith, thank you so much for all of that. We're going to take a very quick break, but do stay with us though. The US Open begins tomorrow, so we're going to have our usual Greg Allen preview. Welcome back. We're turning our attention to golf. The US Open gets underway at Oakmont tomorrow. We'll be hearing from Greg Allen very shortly, setting us up for those few days. But first, he was speaking to Shane Lowry and Rory McIlroy.
This is an event you've come so close to winning. Your motivation levels, you've spoken about them somewhat being a questionable part of your psyche since the Masters. The US Open requires full attention. What's your attitude towards Oakmont, the ultimate US Open test probably?
Yeah, it is. You have to have a ton of patience, and then you just have to be unbelievably accepting of whatever happens. I obviously want to play well here. I didn't like what happened last year. I didn't like what happened in LACC, you know, and I feel like I'm playing US Open golf and venues much better at this point in my career than I ever have. So I don't want to go in there feeling like I want revenge or want, I just want to go out and play my golf. And, you know, if I can do that and hit the shots and stay patient, you know, hopefully I'll be, you know, there on Sunday with a chance.
Things have been going well. I'm hitting the ball well. My arm play is very solid. And if I can keep doing what I've been doing for most part of the year this week, I'll do all right.
I think you told the story yourself after 2016 when you finished runner-up here at Oakmont in the US Open, that you came here on the Sunday beforehand and you went off after five holes saying, I can't play this course, I don't know how to play this course, and you went that and shot 68 on Thursday and you're off and running. What is it about Oakmont?
Look, I like the look of the place. Because I played well here in 2016, people automatically think I'm going to play well this week, but I don't think like that. Always on the edge of my anxious self where I'm, you know, I want it so much, but I don't want to think that my confidence levels can't be too high. I just need to be myself and I just need to bring myself back down to earth and, you know, throw all my expectation away going to that first tee and give it a run.
So that was Rory McIlroy and Shane Lowry. Now let's join Greg.
Game on.
Golf.
I'm with Doug Ferguson here of Associated Press at the US Open at Oakmont in 2025, and another US Open, another daunting challenge. So much talk about the golf course this week, Oakmont being arguably, if not admittedly, the toughest US Open of all, if not one of the toughest golf courses in the world. Doug, you've just actually stepped out of the USGA press conference, and they speak about matters golf course and how tough it is going to be over the next few days. What have they said about the challenge ahead?
I've never seen the USGA so excited about a US Open to get started, because they love it here, and they don't have to do much. They're not going to adjust much. The rough is going to be 5 inches. I think what they kind of said, but not outrightly, is that the height of 5 inches is not an issue. It's the base of the grass that is so gnarly that it's a good proper test, and they love it, and they don't have to do much. I would suspect they do less work going into this US Open than most other courses. The greens are the greens. They're the fastest in America, probably. Faster for the members from what we hear. And the rough is hit the fairway or it's going to be a great challenge. And there's no secret. There's no water on this golf course. There's ditches and there's rough. And the bunkers, I think, as Scotty said yesterday, are very underrated. But, and it's a terrible phrase, Greg, but, you know, the idea that it's right there in front of you, there's no secret to this place. You've got to play good golf.
Before we get into the prime two-pronged Irish challenge, everybody's referring to Scottie Scheffler. 3 wins in his last 4 events, one of them a major, finally cranked into the same level of form that he had in 2024 when he won 9 times. It does look tailor-made for the world number one, doesn't it?
Everything does these days, frankly, but it does. And I think, interestingly, especially about Oakmont, I think we've come to an epiphany in the last probably 3 weeks or so. All the statistical comparisons, Scottie Scheffler with Tiger Woods in terms of the ball striking and everything else, Scottie's more like Jack Nicklaus than he is Tiger Woods. He's a guy that plays the game from tee to green, make a few putts here and there, post a good score, and limit mistakes. I mean, listening to Jack talk at the Memorial and watching Scottie play, we're almost looking at a very similar player, minus the number of children.
Actually, Scottie Scheffler came here, I think, in 2016 as a 19-year-old amateur, just short of his 20th birthday. Shot a subpar round, 69 in the first round, was tied for seventh place, eventually missed the cut. Will you forgive him that with a 78 round here and the dizzying experience of being so high after the first round? But it shows you that, you know, he's a much better golfer now, and clearly he liked what he saw in 2016.
Yeah, and I think it is tailor-made for him, for a guy who is renowned for controlling his golf ball.
So much happens in the world of golf in the space of even a few weeks, possibly a few months. Rory McIlroy won the Masters in April. Scottie Scheffler was fourth, hinting towards a return to form. Since the Masters, Rory has done a lot of celebrating. He's had problems with his driver, problems with his motivation, he says. Scottie Scheffler has won three times in that period. Rory hasn't played very well. I think a seventh place in the Truist Championship in Philadelphia, his best performance, and he's missed a cut in the Canadian Open last week. Where do you rate Rory's chances here of even getting to Saturday and Sunday and being possibly in contention?
I don't think the Saturday-Sunday part is something that we think about. I mean, it'd be a surprise if he missed the cut. Let's just start there. Getting in contention, he's not at the top of your tongue the way he was after the Masters at the PGA. The motivation part was really interesting, and I get it. But he's got to, you know, he mentioned the word reset, and he's got to find that and realize there's more golf to play. I realize that, as he said at the PGA, nothing will ever beat the highlight of his career like what happened at Augusta, and that's understandable. But there's more to achieve, and I think he knows that. He's just got to find it. I think back to the difference between Nicklaus and Johnny Miller, where Johnny scaled the mountain and said, now what? And Jack scaled the mountain and said, where's the next one? And I think at some point Rory needs to start looking for the next Alps.
Yeah, that's, I think, perhaps the biggest part of what he faces now. And there was this narrative after the Masters, oh, he's going to start knocking off plenty of other major championships now that he's got the monkey off his back and he'll be freed up in the majors. But actually the opposite seems to be happening right now before he possibly gets to the good stuff.
Yeah, I think we all kind of assumed, and we don't know because we're not in his shoes and we're not in his head. Freedom was the word that was used quite often. He'll now have freedom. He's got the burden. He can just go play with great liberty and swing freely and all this stuff right here. But again, you're wondering about the driver, especially missing the cut at the Canadian Open. And it just goes back to how badly do you want it.
Shane Lowry has now become a player who you're talking about are certainly aware of almost every week in the PGA Tour because he's not only the Open champion from 2019, but he's very consistent. He's been runner-up in two PGA Tour events this year. How do the wider sort of American, I suppose, media regard Shane right now? Because clearly he's in his late 30s, but playing the golf of his life.
From the golfing standpoint, you know, we've seen Shane at his best, whether it was Portrush, whether it was Firestone. What he's lacked and what he's gaining is being there every week. Doesn't mean winning every week, but golf is all about chances. It's all about getting there, like Padraig used to say back in the day, show me where I am going into the final nine on Sunday and let's see what I've got. And Shane is kind of reaching that stage, and enough times and you'll cross it. But, you know, the Truist Championship at Philadelphia Cricket got your attention. You think back to here, the fact that he had a 3-shot lead going into the last day. He knows how to handle this golf course. That was then, this is now. But his level of consistency and his great hands never leave him. He's starting to get a lot more attention, I think, beyond questions about Rory.
Yeah, obviously Shane Lowry with that lead going into the final round in 2016 here at Oakmont in the US Open. Didn't get it done on Sunday, but he certainly, you know, showed a loving and a liking for the challenge here, which not everybody else does. If not Rory, if not Scheffler, if not Shane, who do you kind of look at possibly as being up there? Because, I mean, the runners-up in 2016 around here were Scott Piercy, Shane Lowry, and Jim Furyk. You know, and Jim Furyk is a steady eddy, not long hitter. So who do you think might possibly pop out of the pack and be a contender?
So Jim Furyk might be your Larry Nelson. And I only say that as you look back in the last 60-odd years at Oakmont. Look at the size of these winners. Jack Nicklaus with those telephone poles for thighs. Johnny Miller, a power player, a great, you know, streak player, but a long hitter. Angel Cabrera, Ernie Els, Dustin Johnson. These are all physical specimens, and I can't get away from that. So I'm not saying you have to be able to lift 500 kilograms to win this thing, but when you look at the rough and you just look at the power that helps so much here, to me it's hard to get away from John Rahm and Bryson DeChambeau? Because to me, the second toughest course for U.S. Opens has always been Wingfoot, which is where Bryson won a couple years ago by powering his way with wedges out of, you know, pretty thick rough itself. So those two, to me, stand out as the people that don't get talked about because we're spending too much time talking about Scotty and Rory.
Yeah, and actually, and DeChambeau and Rahm were right in there on the back nine on Sunday in the USPGA Championship just a few weeks ago. Doug Ferguson, as ever, pleasure chatting to you in advance of the US Open here at Oakmont, and let's hope we have a good 4 days.
Thanks, Greg.
Game on. GAA.
Now it's time to turn our attention to Gaelic Games. I'm delighted to say that Damien Lawler is with us, as he is every Wednesday. Damien, it was actually a very busy day from a GAA News perspective, so we better get straight into it. And we may as well start with Casement Park, because there was an update today. You may take us through, please.
Yeah, basically, Marie, the project has been going on for, I say, as long as I'm on this planet anyway, or it seems. It's currently sitting at around £270 million. And the Irish government has given money, Stormont's given money, and there was a lot of pressure on the British, the UK government to provide, you know, the outstanding monies that was, I suppose, on the cards. And just to give some context, you know, UK government has given money to Windsor Park and to Ravenhill in the past, and Casement Park was the third part of the trilogy. Everybody in the GAA was waiting for the donation. But today's news anyway is that the British government has pledged £50 million pounds sterling towards the redevelopment of Casement Park. And look, there's a lot more money outstanding, maybe another 90 million, but this could see the finally could see ground broken on this project. It's been derelict for over a decade. As I said, Marie, 270 million is now the cost. It's probably rising every time as well. But I think now it's a case of who comes up with the shortfall and who provides the rest of the money. Inflation is growing all the time. The cost of building is rising all the time. And now the spotlight comes back on whether the GEA will stump up more money or whether Stormont will stump up more money. But today's announcement is significant. It could finally get the project up and running. And I think if they don't act fairly quickly, Marie, there's an estimate that the cost of Casement Park goes up 140,000 sterling every month that nothing happens. So you're talking now maybe about a 32 or 33,000 capacity stadium. It's been downsized a bit, but at the same time, there seems to be growing momentum and belief that a home for Antrim GEA and indeed for Ulster GEA is a step closer now.
GAA President Gerald Burns has spoken at length in the last number of years about the importance of Casement Park and getting that money from the Stormont executive. What was his reaction to today's news?
Yeah, I think cautious would be the word I'd use. Like, I mean, definitely welcomed the news. There's no doubt about that. You know, Croke Park have worked really hard with Ulster GEA and the executive behind the scenes to get that funding. The lobbying has been intense and it's been immense. The bottom line is they still don't have enough for Casement Park. So they're waiting to see now what maybe Stormont can do in terms of its inflationary uplift to the €62 million that it promised back in 2010. And I think the job is not over now. They'll probably go back and maybe lobby Stormont. They might have to revisit their own allocation or own pledge themselves, Marie. But you're talking probably from the region of £90 million to make up for yet. So there's a lot of money. Now, look, you can get around it too. Like, there's naming rights. There's all sorts of sponsorships. There could be other grants that haven't been tapped into yet that could be looked at. But I think £50 million is another shove down the road. And it's a fairly significant one. And the fact that the UK government have acknowledged it in their revised spending bill, it's positive all around, but there's a long way to go still.
Yeah, it's a huge amount of money, Damien, really. Like, and when you think about how far away they are from what they need, is it likely that the GAA are going to have to dig quite deep into their own pockets to try and get this done?
Yeah, you see, like, I mean, I'm going up to Louth tomorrow, Marie. There's a 24 million stadium being developed there. Work has just started on that this week, and it's taken years to get that off the ground as well. And that's like 24 million as regards 250 million. So, like, that's a massive, massive event to a project to get going. Semple Stadium in Thurles needs a huge amount of work as well, Marie. So the GAA has to be very strategic in how it invests its money. But I think that, you know, certainly they'll have to look at their own allocation and see can they do any better on it, because at the end of the day there is going to be a shortfall, and I think both themselves and Stormont might have to go back and maybe examine their allocations to see if there's any more that they can do. So I think the cost of inaction every month is critical here. The sooner they get this sorted out, the better. But I would say today is very significant. You know, I mean, Gordon Lyons attended his first GEA match last month, and that was a hugely significant event as well. And maybe the two events were linked and tied. So I think it's going in the right direction. And I think now, of course, even the project I speak about in Loud has been done on a phase basis. Phase one is it's up to 14 million, Murray. And phase two then is the remainder. So maybe the project can be done, you know, phase by phase and find future funding as they go along.
And what about the Irish government? Do you think that they would give some more money?
Well, they've already given money to that, and it's been fairly generous as well. It certainly could be lobbied for it. But they have a lot of projects on their hands at the moment too, you know. Like, I think everybody has to probably go back and maybe have a look at their allocations and see if there's any more they can do. There's no doubt about that. I think all that will happen. But the Irish government have been extremely generous so far. The GEA have given what they feel. And, you know, there is a feeling all along that, like, it has to be in line with the other projects that the North received as well at the times. You know, relatively speaking, the costs and the inflation were well down on what they are now.
And Damien, just from a pure GAA perspective then, I've heard some voices from Antrim speaking over the last little while as well. And I heard the point made that some kids now don't even have any memories of Caseman Park. And that really struck me, that there's a generation growing up that don't even know about it.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's like people probably get emotional talking about it. Like, at the end of the day, Clonus is... it's become the hotbed for GEA, you know. And I think in terms of the last decade or so, everything has been centred in Clonus. And I think in June the 9th, 2013, Antrim versus Mona, I think. That was the last game in Caseman Park. And that's you know, over 12 years ago now, Marie. So it's very understandable that kids wouldn't have it, you know. And I think people have marched over the years. There's been objections from residents. I think, you know, the capacity has come down in line with that. There was a major funding gap of around £150 million at one stage. That's down now to maybe 90. You know, £62 million was committed to Caseman in 2011. But that was part of a strategy to develop Windsor Park and Ravenhill as well, Marie. So those two grounds are up and running, but the project in Caseman still hasn't been. It was delayed for several years because of those legal challenges as well. So planning permission finally got granted 4 years ago. And the dispute ever since has been over funding. And I think all along then, it was hoped that Euro 2028 would be able to host soccer games, you know. So it's been very, very elongated. And it's been very, very messy as well, you know. So I think hopefully now we can make some progress on this for everybody concerned.
Yeah, definitely. More news then from Jarlett Burns today. So we now know that the prospect of All-Ireland finals moving into August by 2027 could be on the cards. How has this been received?
There's no point in saying otherwise. Like, if you're from a county with a thriving dual fixture list, Cork, Galway, Wexford, Tipperary, you know, just to name a few, there is an argument there that you need 14 to 15 weeks to complete your championships, Marie, in order to have them out the gap by the time the provincial championship starts, in order for the provincial championships to be finished by the end of the year to allow the All-Ireland series to emerge after that. So you have to work backwards. The argument has been made then that if the All-Irelands are stretched to August, some counties might have to revise their club championships and make them more compact. They could lose out on gate receipts. And the other side of it too is that if the season is extended by 3 weeks, for counties who have teams going full tilt in hurling and football, e.g. Cork, Galway at the minute, you're talking maybe, you could be talking an extra 100 grand in that month to keep your two squads moving. Mm-hmm. Depends on how far they get into the season. So I'd say it's aroused a lot of debate today, Marie. You know, there's a huge push out there, no point in saying otherwise, for the season to extend to the first and third weeks of August. At the moment, Marie, you know, you probably have prelim hurling quarterfinals, the hurling quarterfinals, the hurling semifinals, and then the final. That's all you've left in the hurling championship. A load of teams are out. Most of the Gaelic football teams, be it Tailteann or Sam Maguire, are still in contention. That's a major, major difference. So they want to give hurling a little bit more room to breathe. They want to give the Joe Mack more room to breathe, and that's rightly so as well. So that might mean getting rid of the preliminary quarterfinals and letting the Joe McDonagh run concurrently with the Lee McCarthy championship. The Spitz season has been in play 3 years now, and it's largely been well received, but there is a feeling out there it needs to come back a week or two. What you do then with the ladies football finals and the Camogie finals will be very interesting, because I don't think necessarily anybody, including the players, most importantly, want those finals to go back in September, because they have their own personal lives and their club championships to look forward to as well. Mm-hmm. So could you potentially see finals being played ahead of major senior games in the men's competitions? So something will have to be looked at as well. So GPA will also have a say in this. They won't want the load on intercounty players lengthened or heavy than any in any extent. And if you're moving back to season by 3 weeks, that's exactly what that will do. So there's all sorts of connotations, but you do get the feeling from talking to officials out and about at various launches and interviews and that it could be coming up for special congress that provincial final replays could be allowed, and you have to build in an extra week for that then, Marie, and that maybe the championships might go to the third week in August. So there could be debate about that too.
So basically everything is in play now again, Jamie, is it?
I remember talking to you years ago during COVID about this and how it was the saviour. And look, it's gone down really well. I think a lot of clubs and counties would be in favour of leaving it alone. No point in saying otherwise. It does feel a little bit rushed from my perspective, but I wouldn't be changing it by a whole lot either. And you must take into account the needs of other counties, especially the dual counties. And they are Wexford, Galway, Cork, Tipperary, people like that, you know. And clubs like Loughmore, Castellini, that maybe have the same team in hurling and football. So all that needs to be looked at. But Charlotte Burns is definitely open to the idea, and he's also open to the idea that provincial finals replay should come back on the calendar as well.
Okay, Damien, thank you so much for all of that. We got through a lot. I'm sure there'll be more to chat through next week as well, as is the nature of Gaelic Games News. Thanks as always.
Game on. Camogie.
Now we're going to turn our attention to Camogie. I'm delighted to say that Aoife Murray is on the line. Aoife, unfortunately, I'm going to be starting with a negative today, just because of the results over the weekend and just how lopsided some of the score lines are. And, you know, we always talk about how you want the gap to close and how things are looking up and looking better, and, you know, the increased coverage around the skirts. But then you look at score lines like Waterford Derry 5:30 to Derry's 2 points, Tipperary 7:18, Wexford 7 points. And it's hard not to be a little bit worried. Are you worried?
It's hard on the cold face looking at those score lines, and you're going, you know, we try to look at the positive in mm-hmm. fairness, and some of the results give you hope, and then there's a result like the Waterford Derry result, for example, and you go, okay, actually, are we getting further from the line? Like, progress is going to be slow. Like we kept on talking. God, Marie, how many years we've been chatting on this show about Galway, Kilkenny and Cork, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
The three. And now, you know, there is some light at the end of the tunnel with the likes of the Waterfords, Tipperary's, and even your own beloved Clare getting up mm-hmm. higher up on that table, right? But then, unfortunately, it is somewhat watered down by those results. The likes of the Derrys and the Wexfords who just got and it's the only way I can put it, it's got an absolute beating at the weekend. And you would go for the promotional of the game, because, unfortunately, the majority of the time that Camogie is in the press is for the negative stuff, like the whole Scort conversations of recent. And that's probably a worry for me is when you do get those positives, it gets so watered down by lopsided results.
Yeah, even like when you look at the Premier Junior and like Armagh 7:37, Louth didn't score. So like for me, the big worry is if you're a young girl and you're going to training, or, you know, like a teenager, and you're going training every week, and then you're mm-hmm. in games like this. How do you keep them coming back and keep players interested and keep developing the game when you're suffering a significant loss like that?
Yeah, it's a hard one. And look, I'd love to have one answer mm-hmm. for it. And like, as I said, progress is slow, but then you look at Derry at senior level, right? You know, this is meant to be the premier showcase for our sport, right? And that's no disrespect to the junior and the intermediate side of this. But at the premier level, Derry only coming out scoring 2 points.
Yeah.
You know, you can't blame conditions at this stage of the year for that. And I think there needs to be a serious review looked into this. And particularly, you know, Derry were getting further away from being more positive on the scoreboard. But look, it is probably, what is it, the third defeat this championship. It's very hard to get yourself motivated the next time you go out. It's a long-winded way of saying I don't have an answer effectively for you. But it is a hard one for the county boards. I do think that's where the review needs to come into place. We're so focused on integration. We've been so focused on the scores issue that actually we now need to look at standards. And standards within the counties. I always go back to even my own experience, right? You know, in 2012, I'm telling you, we could barely touch our toes. It took us a couple of years of that S&C, really building that foundation for what you probably see now in 2025, the condition, the skill level of the Cork team, you know? It took us a couple of years and we had a fairly strong foundation. You know, so to me, it's going into those grassroots and understanding where are the deficiencies and how do we start to target that over the next 5+ years.
Yeah, because in a way, we're talking about the gap growing, but then you're looking at the two group tables and, you know, they're tight there. And there are some counties that are making progress, as you said, a bit like Clare. So they're positives, too.
Look, there is, and that's the thing that we need to try and focus on at the same time, right? We're not going to fix it. We're in the middle of championship right now, okay? So let's look at the positives. You've got Waterford at the top of Group 2. You have Cork on the top of Group 1. However, if you just look below Cork, you've got Clare and you've got Limerick. Like, that's great to see. I know Clare or Limerick have a game ahead, but seeing Clare at number 2 there, now they've got eyes on the quarterfinal. You know, and that's a big step up for them. If you look at the likes of Tipperary, look at Waterford and even Dublin, getting those experience of quarterfinals year on year on year now has put them into the mix for the semifinals. And almost looking, not even looking at the quarterfinals anymore, right? You know, it's now semifinals or finals. Looking at Group 2, Waterford on top, same games played as Galway, and slightly ahead just on score difference. And Kilkenny jumping to 3. And now you've got that kind of fight in many ways between Dublin and Kilkenny with regard to trying to get into that quarterfinal spot. So there is some positives. However, unfortunately, it just gets watered down by some of those one-sided results.
OK, well, look, we'll leave it there now. We'll finish on a positive. Aoife Murray, thank you so much. Hopefully we won't be seeing too many more of those kind of results as the season progresses. But it is very important to address them all the same. Thank you so much, as always.
Thank you.
Game on. Ladies football.
Now we are going to talk ladies football to the end of the show. I'm delighted to say that Nadine Doherty joins me on the line. How are you, Nadine?
I'm great, Marie. Welcome back.
Thanks very much. Glad to be back. Glad to be chatting the championship with you. It is underway and happy days. It was a great game between Waterford and Dublin. Highly entertaining, Nadine, but I'm not sure Waterford will be too happy. Did they leave it behind them?
I think they will feel that they did, Marie, and I think they did as well, no more than the Munster final against Kerry. As you said, it was one of the best games we've seen in a long time. There was a great crowd, great atmosphere. Waterford, they fully deserved every cheer and clap they received because they were absolutely brilliant. They just, Marie, like they have done in the last few games, they just weren't clinical enough. I think they converted about 50%. There were stats at halftime, and I think they were around 50%. And that came back to haunt them in the end. There was a big moment in that game for them. There's 10 minutes to go. They were up by a point, and Claire Walsh had a goal chance. She was brilliantly held up by the Dublin keeper. But I felt it could have been a penalty, to be honest. Leah Caffrey got two hands on the player. But look, penalty wasn't given. Waterford might see that as, you know, what I suppose caused them to draw the game. But I think for them, as I said, it was just too many wides. And Dublin, look, in fairness to them, Marie, Dublin are Dublin. They didn't give up. I think it was like 4 points with 2 minutes to go. And they got back at them. And Kate Sullivan was absolutely unbelievable. throughout the game, actually, Marie, even though she scored that equaliser, she was brilliant. Her tackling, she kind of almost put in, you know, a Lindsay Davey vintage display of tackling in the forward line, and just she finished everything. Hannah Turrell for Dublin, she had a quiet enough game, but she still scored 1-5. And I think for Waterford, Marie, that's what they're missing a little bit, is like a marquee forward who, even though they mightn't be in the game, any chance they get, they'll take. But listen, Waterford, even without Kellyanne Hogan, they still have a big say in this championship, and I just see them improving as the next few weeks go on.
Yeah, it's early stages yet. The defending champions, Kerry, left it a bit late, beat Mayo 13 points to 1-4, but they still have a way to improve, do you think?
Yeah, definitely, Marie. It was a funny enough game, I suppose. It was one that Kerry were never going to lose and didn't look like losing. And Mayo were probably more competitive than Kerry perhaps predicted. And in saying that, Kerry did line out without loads of regulars who we'd be familiar with, Danielle O'Leary being one of them. And she came on at halftime, Marie, and she scored 4 points. She for Shea knocked over 4 points. But yeah, they definitely have to improve. And I feel what I learned from Kerry in that game was that their squad probably isn't as deep as they would like it to be. I think they also struggled to break down a very solid Mayo defence. So, I mean, if they come up against something like that later in the championship, they might struggle. And I think without O'Leary in that full forward line, without that outlet, they need her in there to bypass that blanket defence. And I think what was really highlighted as well was their lack of pace in the middle, because Reap for Mayo was absolutely brilliant. Young player, she's fantastic. And I think, you know, looking at Kerry, because they are looking forward, you know, if they come up against the likes of Vicky Wall, Emma Murray, that Galway and those Armagh half-back line midfields, they will struggle. But look, they have nothing to worry about at this point. But I think huge credit to Mayo as well, because especially in the first half, because they are coming from a lot of big losses and they were absolutely brilliant. So you have to give them huge credit for that performance.
Do you think the Meath Armagh draw was a fair result?
Yeah, definitely. It's funny, like the quality wasn't as good as the Dublin Waterford game, but it was really, really entertaining. Definitely a fair result. Do you know what it was, Marie? Both teams, whether they were nervous or the fact it was the first championship game, there were a huge amount of unforced errors. In Armagh's case, it was more in the forward line. Their last pass was very poor. Their finishing at times was poor. And I think Meath will look back in that video, and in defence, they kicked away so much ball. Robin Murray, their goalkeeper, very casual. I mean, coming out of defence, they probably gave up about 1-3. And then at the other end, I felt McCormick's team selection was strange enough. Like, he had Niamh Galgally at centre forward, Marion Farley in midfield, and I don't think it really worked. But look, I think Armagh will be annoyed that they gave up a 4-point lead in the dying seconds. And obviously, Meath will be delighted to come back. But overall, I think, yeah, it was a fair enough result. Entertaining game, but a fair result, yeah.
And then the other game, Galway beating Tipperary 113 to 7 points. Galway will no doubt have designs on the All-Ireland. What did you make of them? Do you think that they're going to be up there at the end?
I think they are, Marie, because do you know why? It wasn't from their performance at the weekend. That was fairly routine. It was straightforward. Both teams parked the bus, and Galway just had way more pace in the transition. They've serious pace, Marie. I mean, unbelievable. So they got Tipperary in that regard. But I think with Galway, they're definitely there or thereabouts, along with a number of other teams, because this weekend really highlighted the fact that no team at all looks unbeatable. And no team looks like putting together a dominant 70-minute performance against a team of equal level. So there's five or six of them there. And yeah, I just heard Aoife talking about, you know, I suppose the lack of competition at times in Camogie. Thankfully, in this championship, you know, it looks like the majority of the games will be very competitive. And the weekend showed us that.
Yeah, that's really what you want as well, Nadine, isn't it? Because those lopsided results aren't great for anyone.
No, absolutely. And, you know, I suppose I've been very hard on Mayo over the last few weeks because they haven't been going well, and I did expect Kerry to beat them by 10 plus points. But as I said, fair play to Mayo with their, I suppose, their structure and it was their work rate for me. You know, they ensured that wasn't, you know, a hammering for them. So I think more teams will look in that way. And we are finding, and that's the flip side, Marie, you know, the blanket defence is coming back a little bit. And I think we will see a bit of it with Donegal this weekend. You know, James Daly likes to set up in that way. You know, Leitrim will probably have to set up in that regard as well against Dublin and Kildare. So while you don't like to see that in terms of the promotion of the game, it's probably a little bit better than a massive cricket score.
Okay, Nadine, thank you so much for joining us this evening. And that is all from us. I'll be back here on Game On at 6 p.m. tomorrow. And I'm delighted to say that we'll be joined by Katie Taylor ahead of her next rematch with Amanda Serrano. I'll also be joined by footballer Killian Phillips, fresh from his first two caps for Ireland. Plus, we're going to preview the URC final with Bernard Jackman. And we'll be getting the latest from day one at the US Open Golf with Greg Allen.